Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Sarah Doody, an amazing guru UX designer from New York City. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for making time and joining us today. So before we get started, I want to ask you a few brief questions just to have an idea of where you come from and what you're working on these days.
Great.
Fantastic. So Sarah, what do you do for a living?
So I am a user experience designer. I know that has a lot of different jobs underneath it, depending on who you are. So for me, what that means is I'm working with startups that are just trying to get their product out there and helping them validate that idea, prototype that idea, and then do user flows and wireframes for that. And then the other half of the companies that I work for have a product in market and are ready to look at data and tweak their product or get to know their customers further and then adjust their roadmap and plan new features accordingly.
And I also know you do plenty of teaching and writing, and you have a fantastic UX newsletter.
Yes. So in addition to kind of doing user experience, I also am really passionate about educating people. And that started out developing and teaching General Assembly's first UX program, which I think we're going to talk about more. But I also do teaching with various organizations and speaking at conferences, running workshops. And my favorite way to help people continue to learn is through a weekly user experience newsletter that I publish every Friday called the UX Notebook.
Yes, we are going to put a sign-up link on the bottom because it's absolutely value-packed and it's one of the most extensive newsletters that I've ever seen.
Thank you.
Illustrations, various sections, all kinds of news and updates. It's really awesome.
I was just writing up this Friday's last evening, and we're actually at our 150th issue this Friday. So there's a little celebration in store for this Friday.
Isn't that like 3 years of writing?
It is.
Fantastic.
We haven't missed a week, so yeah.
Great. So to that situation where you are consulting and teaching and training, how did you get there?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of people think that just kind of happens overnight, but I remember one friend said, how long did it take you before you quit your job and started working for yourself? And I said, about 12 years. And I think it kind of depressed her a little bit, but it's true. Looking back on my career, I have been in a lot of different types of jobs. I've worked at a big Fortune 500 company. I've worked at a couple of different startups. And so I've seen all kinds of kind of work environments and was really able to figure out, what suited my personality, my interests, my skill set. And after kind of seeing the range of opportunities out there for a UX designer, I realized that for me, working independently allowed me to be able to kind of have my hands in a lot of different industries at once, which I think for a really creative mind keeps me kind of inspired and energized. And also, apply what I learned from, say, a project in finance or e-commerce and apply it to something in publishing or health. I just love that constant cross-pollination of ideas that I get. But I guess in terms of how I landed in user experience, I started out, well, first of all, I was going to study neuroscience of all things, I guess, because I just really loved like how the brain worked and how people thought and things like that, thought and behaved. And then I got into graphic design and web design and front-end programming and finally realized, there has to be someone that takes what a designer designs and what a coder codes and makes sure that what the designer envisions is what the coder builds. And that's kind of where I landed on UX probably 13 years ago or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Could you share your first steps? Maybe that's going to be educational for our listeners.
Goodness. So I actually, you know, I did not study design at all. My education is really funny, actually. So I studied marketing and business, mainly because I honestly didn't know what else to study. But I knew I was really passionate about this world of graphic design and web design and technology and things like that. It never dawned on me to look up a course and say human-computer interaction, just because I honestly didn't even know that term. I had never heard it before until probably I was 3 years into my education. So my education is kind of this mix of marketing and business. And then all my design education is completely self-taught, which if you think back 12 or 13 years, I mean, we had lots of blogs and some industry blogs, but more I was kind of following specific designers and things like that. And I didn't have the luxury of having, you know, a Chinese buffet of user experience programs I could enroll in on every given day of the week like people have today. And I'm really thankful that I'm self-taught because it forced me to learn design as it relates to a lot of different industries. You know, I looked at architecture and fine arts and not just, you know, designing on a screen, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. If, as someone who's also self-taught with 12 years of experience, I'm shaking your head so much here. And I think, you know, practical knowledge and hands-on projects are big school of life.
Yeah, and I think one of the things in hindsight is that I took on a ton of projects that I had no clue how to handle. You know, I remember like getting Dreamweaver for the first time and signing on a client because I said I would make their website and I didn't know even like how to upload files or connect a domain to like a web server or something. So that kind of forced learning, I think, really shaped problem solving and critical thinking, which today is sometimes lost when people have so many, I guess you would say, kind of like plug and play options when it comes to either designing or the accessibility of templates and prototypes and things like that. So there's pros and cons, but most of the designers I collaborate with, including yourself, you know, are not formally educated. So we're in this weird transition time right now, I feel like.
Yeah, and this is pretty exciting, I think. Yes. There is hope for everyone who wants to do that. So, Sarah, what does your typical day look like?
Oh, goodness. It's never typical. It's never really the same thing, mainly because it just varies so much depending on the type of project I'm working on. You know, I might be working on a research project. I might be, interviewing people. I was just spending some time in Stockholm this summer doing research. Sometimes I'm in New York City at a client's office running a workshop or working really hands-on. But I guess at a really, really high level, what I try to do to bring some structure to my day, I try and reserve the mornings for kind of business and operations. So things like doing this podcast or working on my newsletter, working on my blog, doing email, reaching out to sponsors for the newsletter and things like that, and kind of keep that time as my operations time, I guess. And then the afternoon, I really try and reserve that for doing actual client work. So, you know, reviewing research or doing research or working on wireframes or having client meetings, just so that I'm not constantly switching between tasks and getting caught in that kind of loss of productivity that really happens if you're constantly switching back and forth all day long. But, you know, it's never typical. In 3 hours, I have to jump on a plane and go to Minneapolis for a meeting tomorrow and then come back tomorrow night. So you never know what I'm going to be up to. But I love it. I love it. And I think one of the things, you know, if my friends and colleagues were to describe me is that I'm really, really curious about the world and about people and things. And I think that's why I don't mind the travel, because it, you know, lets me see a new place or be at a new airport or, you know, have these experiences that kind of keep my brain occupied and exploring.
Fantastic. So I guess you enjoy that a lot. So my question was, what do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
Well, yes, definitely the travel. But I think I spoke about this earlier. I really do enjoy the ability to work in different industries and take those learnings and apply it to another project, you know, in 2 weeks or in 2 years. I just had a conversation with someone in the automotive industry, and I was really nervous because I thought, I know nothing about this industry, and they were some mega auto engineer. And when we started out the call, I said, I just want to warn you, I know nothing about this industry, so you need to dumb it down for me. But I think because I have those research skills and that background of kind of being able to ask the right questions, I honestly kind of shocked myself in my ability to pick up on this industry. So I think that's what I like the most. The least, I would say, it isn't really concerning user experience, but it's more around running your own business. And I cannot stand all the paperwork and operations and, you know, trying to find new health insurance right now or dealing with paperwork from the government and needing to update this, all that stuff. I just could care less. And one of my goals for 2017 is to never have to do any of that because I work really hard for the next 2 months to get it all lined up for next year. But it's inevitable.
That's
it's
great.
It's a good trade-off, but I wish I could just house that out to someone.
Right. So what is your next big thing?
Oh, my goodness. My next big thing is actually in UX education. So we're going to talk a lot more about this, but I have been working on a variety of different courses, I guess you could say, over the past year, and prototyping different styles of courses, short courses, long courses, different topics. And I have landed on a topic of user research because I feel like it's one topic that has a lot of myths associated with it. And I kind of want to break down all those myths for people and misconceptions so that people have really a playbook or a blueprint to be able to do either a really quick 1 week research project or an in-depth, you know, 3-4 week research project. So all that to say, that should be coming in likely early January, but I'm really excited about it. I've put a ton of work into the curriculum and things like that, and now I have to work through the final 10%, which is always so complicated, and get it out there. But I'm really excited about that one.
Yeah, I heard someone saying, you know, and who's going to do the rest of the 20% of your work? Is it Pareto who's going to do that?
Yes. I mean, things just like learning to use Camtasia video editing and figuring that out and determining, you know, should I do this myself or should I hire someone? So it's all those little things, which I guess my curious mind wants to learn on itself. And my business mind thinks you should hire someone to do this. Stop wasting your time.
Got it. Do you have a URL for that new project so that everyone can sign up?
Yes, that is saraduty.com/UX research. There's a waiting list there. And I'll send you a few other links as well to some kind of resources that I have. One of them is a 65-point research project checklist, which you may not do all 65 things, but it's a good starting point.
Oh, wow.
And the other one is kind of a list of, I think we have about 35 different questions that you could ask in a user research interview. A lot of people, you know, I think are intimidated by research because they don't know what to ask. And so this kind of breaks down the types of questions you could ask to give people at least a starting point.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great.
So yeah, I'll get you links to those as well.
That's great. So let's get to the main point, which is hiring for UX positions. But before we do that, I'd like to mention the sponsor of our episode today, which is Remark. It's this amazing professional formatting tool for your reports and proposals. By using Remark, you make sure that you don't waste enough time, but make sure that your proposals and documents look and reflect all the thousands of dollars of value that you bring to every consulting engagement. We have a special discount. Try Remark today. Visit remark.io with a Q, remark.io, and use the coupon code UIBREAKFAST to receive a permanent lifetime 20% discount. And I can't recommend Remark enough because I think it's a perfect marriage between Markdown format and, you know, the fast plug-in mechanisms that allows you to get a professional-looking PDF report in a glance of an eye, really. What about you, Sarah? Do you use Markdown in your workflow?
No.
You should.
I need to check out this program for sure because I was just writing some proposals over the weekend and I thought, I need to find a better way to do this.
Yeah, I think it's a great option. So yeah. Hiring for UX positions. I know we can talk about 1,000 topics with you, but I just came across that recent article of yours with Dan Macron, if I pronounce his name right. And
that's exactly.
Yeah, it brings up so many pain points. How do you find the right person for your UX assignment? So many things to talk about. Education, portfolio, specialist versus generalist. What shall we start with?
Maybe we should start with the problem. I mean, whenever we started brainstorming and thinking about this article and the bigger topic, it really stemmed from the surge in number of programs that are available to learn user experience. And there are obviously a ton of options out there, but the kind of instigator for this, or the thing that pushed at least me over the edge, was seeing that there were programs out there that were a week long that told students they'd be kind of portfolio ready after a week. And I thought to myself, that's funny, because I've been doing user experience for, you know, 13 years or so, and I feel like I'm learning something new at least every week, if not every day. And so for me, that was really the trigger. And granted, you could familiarize yourself in a week, but just the notion of being able to be portfolio ready, quote unquote, was a little ambitious. So that's kind of how this whole thing got started. And I think the main takeaway after writing a couple of articles and talking to a lot of either UX designers, senior designers, junior designers, hiring managers, is that we need to change the perception that the UX or the education of UX is really never over. And if you want to get into the field, I feel like you need to be prepared to be on kind of a lifelong journey of education, because technology and the way people use technology is just frankly changing so fast. We haven't even had the iPhone for 10 years. It'll be 10 years this summer. So
yeah.
that kind of puts things into perspective.
Absolutely. So there is the General Assembly program that's kind of, it's quite famous and therefore controversial. I'm not sure. I'm not very familiar with their offerings. I think I heard that you were involved with some of them. Is that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could give us politically correct version of that, why it's famous and why it might be not so popular, or is it?
Definitely. So way back in 2011, General Assembly approached myself and my co-author on these articles, Dan Macron, to create the curriculum and kind of imagine what a 12-week user experience program would look like. And so we created this entire curriculum and we taught the course over 12 weeks. And, you know, in hindsight, well, let me back up. The course was a mix of why user experience matters, the UX process, taking you through kind of research, idea validation, wireframing, prototyping, and then feature prioritization, and hopefully through your launch. And we wanted to give people, you know, a 15,000-foot view. And the intention really wasn't that someone would be ready to go and be a senior UX designer, but that it'd be giving them a good foundation. And so during the course of teaching that course, we quickly realized, wow, this could be, you know, a 24, 36 week course, not just a 10 week or a 12 week course. And we tried to do a mix of really hands-on through having students do their own projects and lots of lab sessions and things. But, you know, when all was said and done, we really wanted to iterate on that course because we just saw, A, the hunger for it, but B, how there was need beyond, you know, the first 12-week course, but there could be a lot of follow-up courses. So through a series of events, we kind of taught that course once and ended up not continuing to teach it with General Assembly. But I guess the way that General Assembly got really popular from my perspective is just kind of one of those lucky timing things, really, which is why a lot of startups actually succeed or fail. They kind of were one of the first movers in the education and course space, and they were in New York City. I'm guessing their second major market was San Francisco, and they just were able to establish themselves as the front mover. And so that's how they really have been able to become this kind of mega education company. I'm not even sure what you would describe them as, but that's what I would call them.
Right.
And, you know, I would say, whenever we wrote these articles, which we'll link to, the intention was never to, you know, speak negatively. It was more to kind of raise a yellow flag and say, these courses are a good starting point, but the perception of what your outcome should be needs to be a little bit level-setted, because the idea that you are ready to get hired or go on a bunch of interviews after a month a week is a little far-fetched.
Absolutely. So,
I guess I would say a lot of students and General Assembly instructors put a lot of great comments on there, really agreeing. I mean, there was very, very little pushback, which I was honestly surprised about. So I think we just kind of hit a topic that a lot of people are thinking and maybe not a lot of people had addressed yet.
Yeah, since we are talking from the angle of hiring, and we are definitely touching education here, we see a whole range of options you can get. You know, you can get a candidate from a qualified, highly respectable design school. We can get a self-taught candidate with 5 or 10 years of experience. We can have someone out of the door of, you know, General Assembly course. How do you determine which, and of course, there's a price tag attached to any of these offerings.
Right.
How do you determine for your task who's the most appropriate candidate?
Right. So the hiring of UX designers is really tricky. I definitely don't envy anyone hiring UX designers. I've hired a couple myself over the years. And, you know, honestly, it's challenging because these programs, although they provide a good foundation, I think sometimes they give the designers a false sense of confidence, as well as hiring managers. And I think that a lot of companies hiring UX designers are kind of looking for one person to come and save the whole user experience. And we still have done a really poor job of educating people about the different roles in user experience design. So whenever a company is hiring a UX designer, I really think they have to get very clear, not just on the title, whether it's user experience designer, UX, UI, front end, unicorn, whatever, maybe throw the title away and force yourselves to sit down and write out, you know, the exact things that this person will be doing, maybe even that you hope for them to accomplish in the first 90 days. I just saw a job description that I thought was very clever, and it didn't kind of focus on titles, but it said, here's what you're going to do for us in your first 3 months or something like that. You're going to conduct a research project with our, you know, 20 active users. I'm kind of making this up, but you can see the difference when if you focus on a title versus focus on outcomes. So that would be a major tip I would give anyone who is hiring a UX designer. I would say, from kind of a skill set perspective, of course you want someone who can, quote unquote, do the work, whether that's conduct research, make wireframes, do user flows, look at analytics, things like that. But what I also look for are kind of, what is the person's personality? Do they have those soft skills that are so, so critical to kind of navigating all the different relationships that you have to juggle as a UX designer?
Yeah, that's so true. I would say it's really important to do the prep before you hire anyone, and you describe, write down that job description, that you kind of come to peace in inside your mind what exactly you want this person to do and how you're going to accept their work results. Because if they do research and discover something unpleasant or unrelated to your current product, what are you going to do? Are you going to revamp it? Mm. Or what's your plan?
No, that's a great point, because a lot of times the job of a UX designer is to sometimes be the bearer of bad news. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've done this, do a research project and then realize, oh, this problem that this startup thought they were going to solve actually is not a problem. Mm-hmm. I just ran a workshop in London, and a couple of attendees asked this question, you know, have you ever had to go back to a client and say, you probably should not build this product? And I definitely have had to do that. And it's a very awkward conversation. But I guess that really brings us back to kind of the idea of soft skills. And in order to deliver that bad news, you can't just, you know, plop it in their lap. You really have to craft the story around what research you did, how you did it, who you spoke with, and take what you heard and kind of weave it into this story that the founder or the company can kind of come to accept and kind of connect the dots, if you will, and be in agreement about the recommendation you're giving rather than be resisting that recommendation.
Right. And I'm listening to a consultant with 12 years of experience, but now the person who you hire might not be so diplomatic and experienced.
Yes. Yes. And that just goes into, you know, a lot of these skills that I think a course cannot teach you, you know, like, how do you deal with that stubborn stakeholder that just refuses to take the best knowledge that you have and just kind of wants to stand over your shoulder and have you move the mouse? Like, how do you deal with a stubborn stakeholder like that? How do you deal with someone that doesn't want to accept research or someone that wants to race towards a launch date and, you know, burn out your team or slash a ton of features just to meet a date? And I think, I mean, you can teach that to some extent, but most of my experience in navigating those waters really just comes from having to deal with it over and over and over and over and over again, and have this kind of bucket of past experiences that I can draw from and think, okay, this client is behaving just like that one from 3 years ago. And what did I do 3 years ago? Okay, now I know how to deal with this one today.
That sounds great. So going back to the hiring process, it's important to, yes, rather than, you know, setting a title and looking at education, the better approach is to list down the tasks, what exactly you want to get from them, and try to look for, you know, humanly approachable person for these tasks. What about the formal, you know, things you look at? What about portfolios, for example, or case studies? Mm. What's your take on portfolios? Yep. Do you have one?
I I used to have a portfolio everywhere. I'm sure there are portfolio images floating around that I've yet to find online. But yeah, I used to have a portfolio, and actually I used to have a printed portfolio for my web work, which is so cheesy.
Whoa.
But back in the day, everyone had these like really cool silver metallic binders for their portfolios. So I got on that train. But I would say I don't have a portfolio out in public. I do keep a kind of running keynote presentation of all the projects I've worked on. And then if, and that's in bold, a client asks to see example work, then I'll pull, you know, the most relevant projects. However, I will say it is very rare, like less than 50% of the time that someone asks to see any portfolio of mine. And I would say that's probably for two reasons. First, I've been in the industry long enough that I think there's that trust, but also maybe they've come to me through word of mouth. So mm-hmm. there's also that trust. And they've probably read my writing online. And I just think that writing, they think so highly of it. And it's become such a tool for me that they don't need to see the portfolio. But I to answer your question, I do have it when it's necessary, but I don't actively promote it. Portfolios are very tricky because, especially in user experience, a couple of things. First, lots of people just like to put a screenshot of the final website or the app in its, you know, dribble state.
Mm-hmm.
And dribble's that site where you post all your pretty designs and things or wireframes. And I think it just doesn't show you the process and the struggle that it really takes to go through the UX process. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that when you do see these beautiful final images, you're not really sure what role the candidate had in creating those, because oftentimes like a project manager may have a screenshot and it's like, well, I know you didn't make that in Photoshop. So what was your role in that? It kind of is a little bit deceptive. For me, I like to see that, but I also want it coupled with the entire process and also a story around, you know, what was the problem you were solving? What were some of the challenges you encountered in this project? And why does this solution like work? How'd you arrive at it? I just don't want to see a keynote page with the client's logo and a screenshot. And I think designers are kind of lazy and don't do a good enough job about writing the story of the project and just kind of go for the shiny screenshots.
Once again, we're arriving to that thing that writing is so freaking crucial for designers.
Oh my goodness. I have an article I'll link you to that I wrote, you know, writing, if I had one piece of advice, it's for designers need to write way more.
Absolutely. So you'd rather have a case study or read a case study where a designer breaks down their process of work and their role and how they approach the problem rather than seeing eye candy.
Exactly. I would say you really have to go for quality of really going deep with a couple of case studies rather than show me 20 screenshots of apps and websites you've made, because that doesn't tell me anything, you know? And I think, too, it also shows that you're probably not going to be a great designer, because one rule that I have for myself and that I hope anyone I teach knows is that you have to know your audience when you're presenting something. And if you are just giving me screenshots, you don't know your audience. So I think it's a little bit of a foreshadowing as to how thoughtful this person may be in the role.
Yeah, just a hint, because in their real life further on, they'll have to stand up for their own designs in written form 5 times a day. And you really want them to see that skill in action while they are selling your portfolio.
Exactly. You know, you don't walk into a client meeting with your new screenshot and just put the JPEG up on a screen or a projector and say, oh,
cool,
here it is. Here's the new thing. You always, or at least I do, I always say, okay, well, this is what we did last week and this is the problem we encountered. And so here's why we did these things and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you set it up, you give it some context and just kind of screenshots don't show me any context, which I am looking for a lot.
So true. So what about the organizational process of hiring? In your article, you raised that point that it's fine for some people when you make it to the interview, but some people are terrific in the interview and on the job, but their resume looks completely flat, like, and unattractive. how do you make sure as an organizer that you don't sieve out promising people, and how do you make sure as a participant that you don't get sieved out?
Right. Well, that's a great question, because it's very easy to have the hiring manager or other people in the hiring process kind of get excited by pretty portfolios and things. And so I really think it's important for designers to have these kind of case study approach to portfolios, but also for the interview process to be quite interactive and not just, you know, an interrogation, but maybe more of a collaboration. And so going into interviews, I mean, I even experienced this myself. Google's tried to hire me 3 times, I think it is. And their interview process is really interesting and probably not that different from many companies, but part of the process was that they gave me kind of a mock assignment. And then I would say about half the interview was me presenting the process I used to go about trying to solve this problem. And it definitely was a lot of work for me, but it also gave them an opportunity to see my thought process, which is so important. So another part of that interview process was kind of an in-person brainstorm with other designers. So I forget what the problem was, but, you know, they set up some hypothetical problem, and then we just went to the whiteboard and kind of collaborated and brainstormed as though we were, you know, really on a team working together. And so I think if you can reframe the interview as not an interrogation, but as a collaboration or, you know, a brainstorming session, that just gives you a sense of someone's ability to work with you. Not just, you know, will your kind of personalities get along, but how do they think? Are they good on their feet? Things like that. Of course, they're going to be a little nervous, but if you're a good interviewer, you know, you can kind of diffuse those nerves and make the person, you know, comfortable and see how they are, you know, in real time, quote unquote.
So true. I think the core, you know, piece of truth here is giving them the real life problem to work on in front of your eyes. And it might be homework if it's like a hands-on designer. But for UX mm-hmm. positions, indeed, you probably want to be even more interactive seeing their process in action.
Yeah. And I think when you think of the range of roles in UX, you know, it's not just whiteboarding at a whiteboard, but you could be, if you're interviewing a researcher, you could set up some hypothetical topic and then ask the person to interview you. You know, I mean, it's not that difficult. It just takes some really reframing of the interview process and a little bit of homework on our part as the hiring people to kind of get a little bit more creative about the interview process.
One more thing I wanted to touch upon today is, you know, that differentiation between being a generalist and a specialist and how you approach that in the hiring process. And since you're in the field for so long and you've seen, you know, different variations of design craft, craftsmen, mm-hmm. you know, would you give our listeners, because not only designers are our listeners, we have plenty of founders, etc., like okay. a short, brief overview of the most popular UX-related positions that might have different names, like information architect, you know, UX designer, anyone mm-hmm. else. So your short list with brief explanations.
No, that's a good question, because UX is just this umbrella term, and a lot of people don't really get the specific roles underneath that. So let me go back to the generalist versus specialist and why I think that's so important, though. Mm-hmm. I think that for me, I look at my career trajectory and I think, how the heck did I end up where I am? And I think that my ability to be okay at what I do today is really based on the foundation that I'm a generalist. And I never realized this when I was actually, you know, 10 years ago. But what I mean by generalist is that I have a really broad education and knowledge about a lot of things. And that means, you know, going back to my graphic design days and web design, and that I know HTML and CSS and I used to do front end coding in this thing called Cold Fusion, which I don't even know if it exists anymore. But all that to say, it doesn't matter if that coding program or language exists or is used anymore, because it helped shape the way I think, and it allows me to communicate with and collaborate with developers when I need to. And so all those years of doing those ranges of things gave me this really good generalist background. And then by specializing in user experience, when I finally discovered the field, I really tried to do it all. I mean, I wanted to do the user flows. I wanted to do the wireframes. I wanted to do the research. I wanted to do the designs in Photoshop and things. And I tried to for a little bit, but I remember there was a point where I realized I can't do this all because I am going to slow my team down. I was working at a startup. And so we ended up hiring a visual designer, someone to do, you know, the interface design, take the wireframes and come up with the actual design. And for me, that was pretty, it was hard to give up, but it allowed me to specialize even more in the, I would say, experience design side of things. So to part two of your question, you know, underneath that umbrella of user experience, a bunch of different roles. I mean, we have user researcher, someone that is talking to customers, conducting tests, whether that's in person or online, looking at analytics, trying to figure out what people do, but most important, why they do it, and figuring out, you know, that balance of quantitative and qualitative so that the team can make more informed decisions. You also have, you know, the information architect that's trying to figure out how all the information on the website should be organized. How do people respond to that organization structure? And that information architect works really closely with the researcher to make sure, you know, what they create is going to resonate with the users. Then you have what I would call the experience designer. And this is a little gray, but let me explain. So experience design person is really thinking through the customer's journey, you could say. So their user flow in interacting with your product. And that really digs into things like user flows and wireframes and coming up with kind of the structure of the product, if you will. And then we have, you know, an interface designer or a visual designer, you could say, who is taking that kind of structure and interface that the experience designer has made and then making it look amazing and kind of applying visuals to it. So colors of things, what the buttons look like, icons, all that stuff, to really transform it from just wireframes or blueprints to a beautiful, stunning product. But as you're kind of hearing me say, there's a lot of collaboration. The experience designer has to work hand in hand with that visual designer, because I'm working on a few projects right now and I spend hours each week, you know, talking to the visual designer and rethinking things that looked good in wireframes, but now that we're seeing it design, it has to change. And it doesn't mean I did a bad job. It just means that once things transition from wireframe to user flow, you just realize things that are going to need to change. So that's where, I guess, coming full circle, that generalist background really helps, because it allows me to get into the weeds and then also come out and be able to change things as the product and the design really evolves.
Great. Because there is these, you know, there are two labels, UI and UX, floating above our heads. And everyone is asking like, oh, no, tell me the difference between UI, UX. And I'm always happy to, you know, chat about that. But there are concrete specific roles in the flow. And one is, you know, wireframes and user flows, which experience designer performs. I would rather say this is UX, and visual design is probably UI, but they are all making UI and UX and the research.
Exactly.
Person. It's all like a blend of things. You can't differentiate them that well. So it's
exactly.
It's great that you specified those roles, and without understanding the steps that they will take, you cannot hire the right person to complete the steps. Maybe your front-end developer can do the eye candy job pretty well, because it happens. Maybe then you only need the experienced designer. And just figure out in your head what exactly you need.
Yeah, and I think too, you know, there's the whole unicorn debate, which I'm sure is a whole other podcast. But I would say, you know, there are people that can do an okay job. Like you said, a front-end developer can make it look, you know, good, maybe even great. But I think it's just that delicate balance of figuring out, like, are you at your first version of your product and you're just trying to validate your idea? Or are you, you know, iterating your product that's been out there for a while and you have competition on your back and you really need to, you know, push your design? And I think you just have to balance the stage you're at, the expectation of your users, with what your timeline and budget is. And one role that I forgot that I know I'll get hate tweets about if I don't mention is content strategy. Mm-hmm. And we don't hear a ton about content strategy, but I will say this. So many times I have worked on, let's say, a publishing site, a news site, some new blog's the wrong word, like online magazine or some, you know, information type thing. And I can design, you know, your article detail page and your homepage and what your like landing pages for different categories are, but you need that content strategist to get on board and kind of work alongside me and help shape things like, well, how long do we think our average article is going to be? Do we imagine our articles to have a lot of video or have a lot of photos? Or what's the quality of the photos? What's the quality of the videos? All these things around the content, it cannot be an afterthought. If I am designing, I very much prefer to be able to work with real or as real content possible, because just designing with, you know, lorem ipsum and black boxes for video placeholders and things really, really is deceptive. And so we need to have those content strategists, especially if it's a content site.
Really?
To help us, because I have crazily enough designed content sites where
without content,
like the content without content, and it's ludicrous. And I kind of now put my foot down and say, I'm not going to do this until we have content. So I just wanted to mention those guys as well.
That's right. But you don't specifically, you might not need a specific person labeled content strategist. It can be very well done by generalist UX designer like yourself, sitting down, let's say, with an editor, with a chief editor, and just, you know, working through their flow, figuring out what they have, what they are going to have. Because this is also, it's so much tied to economics, like to the money they're going to spend, you know, producing that content. It's a hugely expensive part of any project.
Yeah. And also, you know, like you brought up the economics, you know, thinking through the frequency at which you might publish articles, I mean, or advertiser requirements. So all these things are important. And I guess as well, not just for a content site, you know, that content strategist can help probably with some of the copywriting too. Not all content strategists, you know, are professional copywriters, but, you know, it's not just how it looks. It's also, what those words say that really can influence, you know, whether people take action or not.
Absolutely. They might be, you know, the articles, it's a very widely meaning word. You can say they're tutorials. You can say they're, you know, case studies, whatever in the world, recipes, anything.
Yes. So I want to mention those guys.
Great. That's a great take. Thank you. I think we're running out of time a little bit, because probably there is another hour to talk about hiring. But I think in our discussion today, we kind of instructed designers on how to help hire fellow designers or subordinate designers. But if you were to give a brief advice to, let's say, your founder friend who has no background in UX, what would be your top two or three tips for him to find the right person?
Well, first of all, I would say you should definitely make a designer one of your first, I would say, two hires. And you want to hire a designer early, because they really will help shape the vision of your product. You will have a vision, but the designer can really take that vision and turn it into a product vision. So in looking for that designer, especially if you're a founder doing some type of startup, I would look for someone that has proven success working with an early stage startup. Those people would tend to be just more able to relate to your situation of being early, needing to work a little faster, a little more nimble than maybe a large company that has big budgets and big timelines. I would definitely look for someone that is more of a generalist. So maybe could do the experience design and the research, or the experience design and a little bit of the visual design, mainly from an economic perspective, just so you can kind of kill two birds with one stone. I would also look for someone that might have a little bit of experience in marketing. And I say that because it's really great to, you know, shape the vision of your product and do the wireframes or make a prototype or something like that. But you also need a plan in place to market that product. And marketing just doesn't have to mean posting on Product Hunt and, you know, tweeting and things like that. I really believe that marketing really needs to be baked into your product. And so if you can get someone who can have a little bit of a marketing influence and figure out how to bake that into your product and use things like persuasive design and habit forming techniques and work those into your product, then that'll help you spend less money doing, you know, marketing activities, traditional marketing activities.
Yeah, that sounds great. That's very, very useful insight for anyone who is starting out with products and trying to figure out how to, you know, nail UX when there is nothing yet on the stage.
Exactly. It's a different mindset than being at, you know, a big company and having all the luxuries that come from the resources available to you.
Yeah, I've been in that boat. I miss that a little bit too, like having a team.
I miss that too sometimes.
Yeah, having a team of illustrators and everyone like that, just willing to do everything you wish at a time.
Yeah.
That's lucrative, I agree. So, Sarah, thank you so much. Where can people find you online?
Well, they can find me... first of all, I tweet all the time. I'm really active over there. So you can find me at Sarah Duty on Twitter. You can also find me, like we said, at that newsletter, theuxnotebook.com. And then as well, I have a presence over at sarahduty.com where we have a lot of blog posts and resources, links to courses and things like that. And just, you know, stay up to date on whatever my next big thing is after I get this course
right out.
But there's the main places I'm active.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom today. I hope it brings practical insight to people who are hiring, and this was fantastic. Thank you, Sarah.
Thanks for inviting me, Jane. It's great to talk to you.
Awesome. Have a wonderful day.